The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, this year's Sense About Science lecture focuses on the need to encourage accountability and the deployment of evidence in public life. Tracy Brown looks at how the truth can be an amorphous concept in science, with scientists more likely to hedge claims with caveats, whilst more bombastic statements are made in other disciplines. Tracy wants to encourage the research community to trust the public with the uncertainty in their work, to support scrutiny and the asking of searching questions, to create a culture where organisations outside of science feel obliged to explain their reasoning in the light of evidence. Tracy Brown's 2015 Sense About Science lecture is called The Ugly Truth.
I'm going to tell you tonight what I think the biggest hurdles are for improving the way we use evidence in society. And they might not be what you expect. My title has echoes of an inconvenient truth, but in fact its similarity ends there. Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth was a great title. The phrase captures so well the collision between conviction and fact in public life, something that many of us have run into when pressing authorities to consider evidence. And yet Al Gore's truth came to be the very opposite of what I want to talk about. Climate change in his hands became an ironed out, simplified, and ultimately convenient truth, one which left little space for nuance and uncertainties with its declaration of 6 metre sea level rises and mass extinctions. Well, I'm talking tonight about the opposite of that. I'm talking about how we communicate the truest, richest picture of our world and what is known about it, with all its warts and wrinkles, not ironed out and simplified. Well, each time I refer to truth, there will be a gentle crunch around the room, and that's the philosopher's toes curling into the carpet. What is truth? Whose truth? So I'm going to get right on it. I'm talking about critical scrutiny, questioning new and old wisdom, challenging misrepresentations or oversimplification, not going along with a partial picture. In The White Lioness, Henning Mankell has Wallander pondering the fact that we are taught that the truth is one and whole. He concludes, on the contrary, the truth is complicated, varied, contradictory. Lies, on the other hand, are a matter of black or white. Well, I like Wallander's definition. And anyway, he has 100% clear-up rate. And in a lot of ways, lies and misrepresentation and concealment and oversimplification are much more straightforward. Challenging them to establish a more truthful account is a matter of being prepared to question and correct, not professing a one and only truth with a capital T. But this kind of truth-seeking is not about declaring this is the future of agriculture or here's the problem to stop youth offending, programme to stop youth offending. It's about challenging people who say screening 16-year-olds would prevent more cervical cancer, or drinking milk is linked to autism, or polygraphs can detect child molesters. And as you all know, if you say something like this, an alarm sounds at Sense About Science. A marble rolls along a chute, drops into a funnel, sets off a trebuchet, knocks over some dominoes. One lands on Chris Peter's head and he immediately sends an email to David Spiegelhalter. I'm joking, of course. Some of the emails go to Robin Lovell Badge as well. No, really, we have thousands of specialists on our database, and Chris Peter's superpower is to match each one of them to a headline in the Daily Express. So I'm looking for critical scrutiny of evidence. And that seems simple. If we ask, is it okay to lie, to mislead or misrepresent in public life on medicines, discoveries, products, policies, we answer, obviously not. That's why many of us here are involved in challenging lies and misrepresentations, and it's been part of my job for over a decade. It's why many people support the aims of Sense About Science and of skeptics groups and so on. In fact, there's a very large section of society who are exercised by the need for scrutiny, not just in research, in the research community, but those who've become frustrated by debates about MMR, nuclear power, GM, crime, education drugs, or the promotion of fad diets or questionable policies. Well, that kind of truth-seeking has a clear remit. How can you make good decisions if you don't have the evidence? Or worse, people are making stuff up. We see the false picture, whether it's been painted inadvertently or intentionally, and we try to put it right, right? Things like this. Now, some of you may recognise this as the gopher, a golf ball finder from the early 1990s. I think that some of you might be saying, no, this is the quadro tracker, an explosives detector, or hang on, wasn't Quadro Tracker a drugs detector used by schools and police forces in Florida and Texas in 93? Well, it was that too. But I can see that some of you are quite certain that this is, in fact, the mole on sale in Britain for drugs detection in 1997. It does indeed look identical and is to the GT2000, which went on sale in 2000, and also to the Alpha 6. To detect bombs in the Middle East, promoted at arms fairs by the British Army. But surely it is the ADE-651, sold to security forces in Kenya in 2004 and to the Iraq Interior Ministry for £11 million in 2007, and then used by Iraqi soldiers at checkpoints to search vehicles for bombs as they entered cities. In fact, it's much like the HEDD-1 displayed at Olympia in 2010, and it was in 2010, finally, that a superb investigation by a team from BBC Newsnight revealed that these devices comprise a lump of hard plastic with a car aerial attached and strips of paper inside with magnetic codes. One specialist found it to be rather like a large anti-theft tag. Well, the Newsnight team also found that while the Royal Engineers were promoting it at arms fairs until 2004, the FBI had worked out that it was just a plastic box back in 1996, when it had quite sensibly occurred to them to run some tests. Well, finally, the Crown Prosecution Service began criminal proceedings against the individuals selling these devices in the UK, and in 2013, they were sent to prison for fraud for the sale of over 7,000 devices at £5,000 to £25,000 each. So that was the end of HEDD-1. One morning in February 2013, Sense About Science received an email about a new hepatitis C detector. This is what it looked like. It was being used to detect patients with hepatitis C in Egypt, where the president had been persuaded to endorse it. Now, Egypt has the highest hepatitis C infection rates in the world, which is around 10% of the population. Pressed for an explanation, the detector's promoters said that the device can be primed to pick up the electromagnetic radiation of different types of disease cells. Well, that will be interesting news to the biologists here this evening. Well, having been alerted, we could at least challenge the miracle stories being sent out to the international press. We could at least avoid them becoming yet more unwitting advertising for this black box. And clearly, challenging these kinds of lies is the kind of thing that people who care about evidence should be doing. Sometimes, though, unjustified claims about what is true are not what we would call lies. Not when lawyers are around, anyway. But an obscuring of the truth with innuendo and misleading statements, which we find no less wrong. This is the Baczynski Clinic in Houston, Texas. It offers patients tomorrow's cancer treatment today. That's what the parents of a little girl with terminal brain cancer hoped for when they started raising £250,000 to take her there for treatment a few years ago. It's what the parents of many children with GoFundMe pages are hoping for. According to the clinic, their personalised cancer treatment involves using antineoplastins, which are peptides demonstrating the ability to reprogram cancer cells without destroying normal cells. The clinic tells prospective patients, several institutes have confirmed the anti-cancer properties of antineoplastins, including the National Cancer Institute, 1991. This surprisingly old reference seems to be to a trial proposed by the National Cancer Institute, which was never in fact conducted. And the truth is that the National Cancer Institute actually says, antineoplastins are not approved by the US Food and Drug Administration for the prevention or treatment of any disease. No randomized controlled trials showing the effectiveness of antineoplastins have been published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And antineoplastin side effects can include serious neurologic toxicity, including swelling near the brain. Since 1993, the clinic has been advertising that it's conducting phase two clinical trials of antineoplastins with its patients. That's 22 years. None of these trials has been properly published, and no one has been able to replicate results that Baczynski claims to have produced. The clinic now advertises it's running a Food and Drug Administration reviewed phase three trial. In fact, the FDA told investigators in 2013 that it had halted the trial because of safety concerns. However, patients whose diaries appear on the clinic website seem to think this is what they're enrolled in. I'm guessing that many of them also don't know that Baczynski was disciplined by the Texas Medical Board in 1994 for offering the same treatment he now offers for cancer, for HIV. That he was warned in 2004 and again in 2013 for his treatment claims. Well, we no doubt agree that patients should be told the truth about treatments. In cases like this, though, the ugliness of the truth makes it a bit more difficult than dealing with bomb detectors. Because what is the truth? Something rather unpalatable. There is no antineoplastin miracle. Medicine has little hope to offer desperate parents who will lose their child. And this is where I've found the appetite for challenging misleading claims starts to wane a little. I've dealt for many years now with claims like this, and even people who believe strongly that patients should be fully informed have backed away from these kinds of issues. I don't mean people who have a horse in the race or an obvious incentive for staying quiet. Not that I think that's an excuse. I'm talking about people who are not implicated, who believe we should challenge misleading claims, but finding that they're not inclined to speak up. Because the truth is hard. It can be socially awkward. It can be legally awkward. By and large, though, over the last 10 years, there has been an improvement in the number of people willing to tackle medical claims, particularly alternative medicine. And I've actually chosen the Baczynski example because critics haven't shied away from the difficulty of that conversation. And they've shown it can be done. Some, including bloggers, and the blogosphere is not exactly known for its subtlety, have been very sensitive to the suffering of patients, people who are seeking help at the clinic, while trying to counter the myth that Baczynski is getting amazing results. And what they've produced is an accessible critique. It may not stop people acting out of desperation, but it does at least make a clearer picture available for those who are willing to consider it. For example, those parents who cannot raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for the trip and treatment, who might otherwise feel they've not done enough for their child. But I suspect this is the last time that we're all going to agree easily that the truth needs to be told. Because my next case is a communist plot to deplete the brain power and sap the strength of a generation of American children. Do you know what it is? Fluoride. Fluoridation of the water supply, a public health measure to tackle tooth decay. So here it gets trickier. Discussion about the evidence is complicated by the introduction of a social good. No one sensible is attached to the idea that a bomb detector that doesn't detect bombs is a good thing, and nor think it's okay that desperate patients pay thousands for false promises and unsafe treatments. But exposing a public health measure to critical scrutiny risks damaging the ability to implement it effectively, which introduces a host of problems with challenging the evidence behind that public health measure. Well, I looked at fluoride recently because members of the public have asked Sense About Science about it. And I was surprised that relatively few people have looked critically at the evidence. I'm not talking about the critics who believe that fluoridation is a conspiracy to allow the phosphate industry to dump its toxic byproducts, or people who believe that this was how communists were advancing their social program. I was one once, and I can confirm that we never had a meeting about fluoride. There's been some criticism from more reasonable people about the way that governments went about fluoridation in the 50s, by stealth, without discussion, which caused a backlash. Many have criticised the ethics of that, and also made the pragmatic point that you put the programme at risk. But that blatant paternalism of the 50s makes a lot of people squeamish today, but I'm interested here for a different reason, which is how tolerant the medical research and policy sectors have been of some very old and questionable evidence. I mean, it's asserted in the UK and the US that the optimal fluoridation level is one part per million to protect against tooth decay without causing fluorosis, where the fluoride is deposited in bone and tissues, most notably on the teeth with the characteristic white and brown staining. And this is based on studies conducted in the 30s, using observational data from areas where water is naturally fluoridated. There were no controls for economic status or any other factors, as we now expect of evidence in public health. It's, of course, difficult to measure the dose of fluoride that people get from water. A hot summer can treble intake, and recent studies have found that much higher levels in individuals than recommended, and also a high prevalence of fluorosis. But the last 30 years have also shown that the very relationship between fluoridation of water and the population's dental health is not strongly founded, even if it once might have been when dental decay was more prevalent and other preventative measures weren't in use. This is the trend in the number of people and the number of decayed teeth by country. Well, apart from a few anomalies, Austria appears to have introduced gobstoppers around 1978, and the Dutch only started counting their teeth in the 1980s. But apart from a few anomalies, there is no discernible difference in declining tooth decay between fluoridated and unfluoridated countries. This near universal fall in decayed teeth has been attributed to fluoride in toothpaste and improvement in dental hygiene and dentistry. Well, some argue that this masks residual problems for a socially deprived population and the measures needed for them. That's a good argument. And more generally, it's an issue in public health. It's administered to everyone to produce benefits only for some, which makes it quite a hard sell. And so a lot of public health campaigns avoid painting too clear a picture of the evidence and who benefits. But here I think we're looking at something else going on, a different reason why a critical lens hasn't been turned on the evidence, which is that many things have simply acquired the status of being unquestioned. I mean, you may be surprised that a whole public health programme over decades rests on fairly slim evidence. But it's not so rare. We've just seen cholesterol and heart disease as a model dismantled. Ansel Keys made the association between fat consumption and coronary heart disease in the 50s. Critics at the time pointed out that he selected countries to prove his point, and they published fuller data showing the correlation was weaker and more contradictory. But as big hitters in public health began to repeat the cholesterol claim, this was lost. It became established and unquestioned for many years. So it seems that if claims don't wear the obvious badge of quackery or wrongdoing, we're less inclined to question. And even less so if quackery and wild conspiracy theories or commercial interest appear to be on the opposing side. But we can't assume that because the good guys are here and the bad guys are there, the evidence must fall accordingly. And of course, that sounds obvious. But I found that questioning is inclined towards the odd and leaves the established too much alone. We're reassured by claims that are established. We assume that someone, somewhere, must have looked at the evidence. You know, worse than this, I've seen situations where people just assume that the status quo must be warranted and backfill with their own explanations for it. I mean, while working on All Trials, the campaign for the publication of clinical trials, I've been astonished at how readily some people have done just that. Clinical study reports, which are the documents that companies produce with their trial results to submit as part of a licensing application, have long been kept hidden. The submitted ones were only available to the licensing body, and others were available to no one. But as well as providing the results, they contain enough detail to avoid others duplicating the trial unnecessarily. When All Trials started, we called for their publication. We couldn't see why they weren't published. We were immediately lectured about how unworldly we were. It was impossible. They were hundreds of pages long. The information throughout would breach patient confidentiality. Intellectual property couldn't be protected. It was highly complex. You would assume these excuses were concocted by the pharmaceutical industry. But we heard them from organisations and even senior medical figures too, none of whom had a horse in the race. They just accepted the status quo. In fact, ironically, it was pharma, GlaxoSmithKline to be precise, that showed how hollow these excuses were. They had a look at their old clinical trial reports and said that the problem was minimal. They could be released without the Earth having to shift on its axis. They removed the excuses. The established wisdom evaporated. So there's another reason that diminishes the appetite for truthfulness, and that's liking the outcome. I think people often stay silent about facts and figures where their pet projects and their social convictions are concerned. So I've learned to realise over my years at Sense About Science that some of the people who say we need to help the public understand the evidence mean just that, but others mean we need to get people to do what I approve of, or I want people to care about the things that I think are important. Well, to a degree, that doesn't matter. You know, we're not dispassionate observers. We're not information machines. Most of us think that there is a social good in herd immunity to diseases that make children blind, when farmers growing more wheat with less land, or increasing energy efficiency. We're motivated by wanting outcomes, which is fine as long as everyone realises it. The reality is it has to be fine. Political and social motives and an understanding of context are as important to human interaction as facts and evidence. And they're the source of good sense, imagination, and compassion. We don't want a world run by the amoral sort of fact-checking equivalent of traffic wardens. So it doesn't matter that people who want to promote evidence have motives. It doesn't matter until those things, evidence and motives, pull in opposite directions. People think they want truth, they think they want evidence, but it turns out they want people to stop smoking or lose weight or reduce their consumption more. And we're sucked into the good lie, promoting or just going along with dubious evidence for the sake of a social good. Staying silent because talking about the gaps and flaws would mess up a message you like. So evidence messes up the message. But what if an even trickier situation where people are keen to probe and present the evidence, but evidence and its uncertainties have become weapons in a row? Very often a row involving absolute conviction on one side or both. You know, there's this moment in a radio interview that every researcher dreads. Yes, Dr. Know-it-all, but are you certain? You know, researchers say to me, the problem is, Tracy, people who don't care about the evidence can say what they like. They can say GM foods aren't safe, we need more prisons to reduce crime, the HPV vaccine is causing chronic fatigue, or the climate's warmed by more or less than it has. And in response, what do we have? Caveats, probabilities, and error bars. And the temptation is to simplify, to flatten out the uncertainties, or to stay silent while others do that. Because to insist on the uncertainties would be to break ranks or give succour to one side or another's inaccurate claims. People are silenced by fear that uncertainty will be misused. What illustrates this most for me is the debates about climate. How intimidated everyone came to feel about having any kind of frank discussion about the evidence. And I felt it myself. The likelihood that questioning or correcting misinterpretations would be seen by one side as an endorsement of the other, accused of playing to eco-fundamentalists or big oil. I've never met small oil. When at Sense About Science we wrote Making Sense of Uncertainty a few years ago, the damaging effects of this really hit me, not just on the public discussion, but on research itself. There has been so little debate about the development of models, for example, that researchers have been unable to follow each other's adjustments. Now, the global interaction between researchers on climate is probably unprecedented in its scale and breadth. So what a missed opportunity scientifically to explore the sources of difference, to create better models instead of flattening them into consensus. But with the levels of defensiveness created by political debate, people just haven't felt it possible. Roger Pilker Jr. has rightly said, there is no role of honest broker in these policy-driven debates about evidence. So the choice made by many people who might otherwise scrutinise the evidence has been to withdraw from seeking nuance or debating detail. But I believe that even in these circumstances, you can frame an issue so that the evidence, the best available understanding we have, is something that people can get hold of. I mean, some of the public discussions that we've managed to have precisely on those charged subjects, such as nuclear and GM, crime and drugs, in recent years have shown that very well, even if politicians and commentators have lagged behind. You don't have to just regurgitate research findings and refer to probabilities. It is okay to use persuasive devices to speak in human with argument. But put the uncertainty out there first and guide people through what it means instead of leaving it to be discovered. Instead of hiding uncertainty so that others can't manipulate it, make it clear when others are manipulating it. I mean, the fact that we can't fully model a chaotic weather system doesn't mean that the models are useless. Or the fact that we don't know what causes some cancers doesn't make a lifestyle guru's theory about flushing the lymph nodes any less a load of tosh. I suspect that what often lies behind the reticence is a concern about trusting the public to get it. Concern that you'd have to argue with people about what conclusions can be drawn from uncertain information in circumstances where people don't automatically trust what they're told. Let me spend a minute here on this subject of trust between science and society. Because during my 12 years or so at Sense About Science, scientists and many others have asked so often, how do we gain public trust? And it's like this magic substance that they thought they could get their hands on. You know, you'd find them hanging out at public engagement conferences trying to score some. You got any trust? Yeah, how much do you want? Well, Onora O'Neill, one of our founding trustees, had an excellent answer to the question, how to gain public trust, by being trustworthy, which must surely include speaking plainly about what we do and don't know. But it also struck me always as a strange question. I'd think, why are you asking the way to get the public's trust when you don't trust them? Yes, things can go wrong. If you talk about gaps in knowledge, things can go wrong. And of these different ways in which people are put off questioning some issues, I have some sympathy for why people can choose to stay silent here. It is important to consider context. If you're interested in causes of vaccine damage, would you, amid HPV and MMR scare stories, would you share that? Context matters, but don't just run away. People often ask me what I think are the biggest challenges for Sense About Science's mission, and I guess they expect me to rattle off a list of the most intractable issues like radiation or to say lazy journalists or lazy politicians. But this is what they are, these moments when people back off. Because the sum effect of all this is that it's created immunity from scrutiny for many issues. Of course, you can't challenge everything, but I'm saying this isn't the way to choose. This reticence produces the wrong kind of selectivity. Unconscious, fearful, even manipulative, with little regard to how significant an issue is. I mean, we say we want a fair representation of evidence, but some major policy issues have ended up with very little scrutiny. Some powerful statements and organisations receive no challenge. So what do we do? Well, here's my rough filing system. Note that nowhere in this system is this. Keep things hidden. At Sense About Science, we do often conclude, file one, leave it, but it's a fair cop. You know, there's a lot of stuff put out that's questionable, a lot of stuff. I don't think most of it needs to be dealt with. To take a most trivial example, if a university PR department comes up with the formula for dunking biscuits and promotes it, does it really matter? I mean, we'd have to be having a very idle Friday afternoon at Sense About Science to make that a target. But equally, it's fair game. If someone chooses to pick holes in the methods of this science and expose it to public ridicule, then it was the university that fired first. It's a fair cop. Well, file two is clarify the evidence. It might surprise you that I also don't think that some of the simplifications in public health are major priorities. For example, five a day. It's, in my view, borderline. The World Health Organization concluded that studies showed an association between eating over 400 grams of fruit and vegetables a day and a reduction in chronic diseases. Singapore puts out the message, eat two fruits, two vegetables. The UK opted for five portions. Canada says 8 to 10. Austria says 18. There isn't a study that tells us what the UK gets for five, nor what it should include, and it's all mixed up with other concerns about sugar. Well, Sense About Science help people to clarify all of this. But, you know, public health campaigns do need to use effective ways to communicate something like eat more vegetables simply. I'm not sure that they've succeeded here, actually. I mean, it's been 10 years, over 10 years, its effect has been an increase from an average of 3.4 portions a day to 3.6, which I guess is the most that the middle classes are ever going to influence a national statistic. But I think we can tolerate simple campaigns so long as the fuller picture of the evidence is clear, so that we don't turn it into another cholesterol or fluoride and start assuming that there's some major body of work behind it. My final file, seek accountability and change. I think the big deciding factor here is whether a claim involves authority. Whether in order to make a decision about who we give authority to or how we live our lives, we have to rely on it. You know, now there's a difference. There's a difference between people being misled or making choices absent half the information and people choosing to exercise choices in spite of it. And some years ago, as many of you know, Sense About Science took up homeopathy because the truth about what it contained, or didn't contain, was not well known. The National Health Service appeared to endorse it because government ministers wouldn't stand up to pressure from the Prince of Wales. But if people know what it is and use it, that's their business. We should be very wary of confusing the aim of raising the standard of evidence in public life with telling people how to live. Our focus should be on the institutions that shape society and exercise authority and influence. But I'm afraid that those are the very institutions that these reasons often neglect. And if we want the bodies that influence public life to be accountable for the evidence they use, to reckon with reality rather than to make it up to suit themselves, then the only way to achieve that is through public scrutiny, not private words. Politicians, public bodies, companies, NGOs, news organisations will only feel obliged to explain their reasoning and refer to evidence if that's what they think is expected of them, not just by researchers, but by citizens, voters, customers, supporters and readers. I'll go further. I think the demand for evidence is part of creating public accountability in those authorities, part of the public equipping themselves so that others, sometimes powerful others, can't mislead them. Evidence is not a special plea of scientists or researchers. It doesn't take an expert to ask authorities and organisations who want us to vote for them or believe them or buy their products for evidence. We can ask for their chain of reasoning, for how they reached the conclusion that improvements to the Thames barrier will be sufficient for sea level rises, or that sharing clinical trial results will compromise patient confidentiality, or that confiscating tweezers at airports will help prevent terrorism. There is such a lack of accountability. How can it be that the government in Scotland announces that it's anti-GM, clean and green, while their farmers spray potatoes with pesticide up to 20 times a year? How is it that government ministers can look you in the face and say they know the position on drug classification makes no sense, but then go out and tell the public something different? Why is the Texan Medical Board, tasked with protecting the public, so slow to deal with a clinic that is continually in breach of its conditions? Well, I don't know what the answer is to all of the dilemmas I've raised. It takes judgment about each context. But I do know that if we want these things to change, if we want to appeal to reason and evidence, to test claims and to challenge outdated or inaccurate perceptions, to stop lies, then we have to stop this immunity. You know, we can't talk about informed patients, but ignore the trickery involved in overstating to pregnant women that a CO2 reading will give their smoking away just because we agree they shouldn't smoke in pregnancy. We can't bemoan the state of drugs policy, but nod along understandingly about the problems that ministers would have with conservative backbenchers. We can't talk about the importance of evidence-based medicine while tolerating the secrecy of clinical trial results. You know, we can't complain about the overstatement of certainty in one area, but choose to ignore it in another. We have to end this immunity. Because where there's no scrutiny, there's no accountability. So instead of backing away on this difficult stuff, we must help the public scrutinise it. We must give them the tools to ask for and assess evidence and uncertainty. This is not utopian. I'm no Pollyanna. I'm not lauding and exaggerating the wisdom of crowds. It will go wrong. You'll sometimes lose on evidence to emotive claims, exaggerated headlines, and misunderstanding. But if I've learned anything from Sense About Science, it's that the more you work alongside people, even on the most difficult issues, the more you learn how to cross the pitfalls. And each time you do, you build the stock of understanding of how research works. So imagine the next time you're engaged in a debate, the radio interview question was not, "Are you sure?" but "Do we know enough?" And decisions about public health, the environment, or crime could be taken with the uncertainty out in the open, instead of pushed into a side room with the constant threat of it being outed. Public scrutiny has to be encouraged without fear or favour. Talk about the evidence and uncertainty, what we don't know, even when it makes for a difficult discussion. If we do this, we're giving everyone a break. We're admitting that life is complicated and here's the best we know, so what would you have us do? Because there are some decisions that have to be taken on the basis of uncertain, unsatisfying, and conflicting evidence. This is the ugly truth, and we should face it honestly together. Thank you.
That was Tracy Brown, Director of Sense About Science. The lecture was delivered at the British Library in London. You could read Tracy's introduction to the lecture on the Guardian's Science page. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.